Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Most Americans believe that we are on the wrong track. That's according to Rasmussen. It's a poll that they've been doing for years, and that's what people have been saying for years. America is on the wrong track. Well, Stephen Brill's new book is called Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. In the book, he identifies what is ailing America, what gives people the sense that we're on the wrong track. It's a tale of good intentions and American ingenuity leading us down the wrong path. He joins me now. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
So first of all, so people know where we're coming from, we're talking about America being on the wrong path. That means a lot of things to a lot of different people. What are the symptoms that you see of our decline?
Well, the core of the country, the core of the country's values is the notion, for starters, that people who are poor, people who are middle class can move up, that this is a country of opportunity. There's always been a tension in this country between the competitiveness and, you know, the achievement orientation of a free market capitalist economy. And there has to be competition because that's what really provides the energy in the economy. There's always been a competition between a struggle to have a balance between that kind of inequality of result, if you will, mm-hmm. with the notion that we're a democracy and that certain core aspects of life in America ought to be equal, which starts with, for example, that that people should have an equal say in their democracy. And what I trace over the last 50 years is the steady decline of those values and the way in which that balance has been thrown out of whack. The high achievers have achieved much, much more and are much more entrenched than they ever were, meaning that those who aren't in the top 1% have less of a chance not only to get to the top 1%, but to even hold on to what they have and have as good a life as they now have. One of the amazing statistics in the book is that the typical American family, the typical American parent, no longer has overwhelming confidence that their kids are going to have it better than they did. And that's one of the things that historically drove the country. So that's out of whack at the same time that the sense that we have a democracy that is working, that everybody is in it for the common good, and that our political leaders are being effective in achieving the common good, you know, pretty much nobody has a sense of that anymore. So, you know, one way to shorthand this is if you're a Republican, this book explains the 50-year process, the decisions that were made, the people involved, the forces involved that took us from Eisenhower to Trump. And if you're a Democrat, it explains all the forces and people and decisions involved that took us from JFK to Trump.
Paint a picture for people who weren't around 50 years ago, what it was like. What there was a group of people who went and tried to dismantle the hereditary privilege that was at the top of the group of people who were at the top of society. And they wanted to, in fact, make it so that people had more freedom to move from class to class, to move from that bottom quintile of the economy to the top quintile more easily. And there is one way that they decided to do, and that was to open up the Ivy Leagues and some top-tier colleges to a wider range of people. What was it like before they opened it up?
Well, what it was like before is what it's still largely like for people who are non-white, which mm-hmm. is you know, those places were pretty much, you know, closed off to people who didn't have a, you know, a class or a legacy right to spaces in those institutions. But, you know, before I explain that, you know, I should note that I'm careful to say in this book that, you know, not everything about, you know, the 1960s was, you know, the good old days.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Far from it. You know, certainly in terms of race relations, for starters, the Vietnam War, you know, there are lots of things that we would not want to go back to. However, in 1967, I was applying for colleges. My family didn't particularly have very much money, but there was this guy who'd been hired at Yale to be the admissions director, and his mandate was to make Yale a more democratic place, open it up. And I was one of the many people who got, you know, a generous financial aid. I was admitted, even though, you know, there weren't, you know, lots of people from my class and lots of people who were Jewish, to be blunt, you know, going to places like Yale. You know, soon after that, they took the even more, quote, daring, unquote, step of actually allowing women into places like Yale. And the point of the book is that, you know, that kind of meritocracy, because I was admitted because I had high grades in high school and, you know, high SAT scores, all that kind of good stuff. Now, that kind of meritocracy is absolutely great. It certainly was great for me. It was great for my wife, who I met at Yale. But it had an unintended consequence, because if you look four decades later, places like Yale and Harvard are now less economically diverse than they were in the 1960s and 70s. Now, why is that?
Yeah.
It's not because they've gone back to only admitting people, you know, who came from the same, you know, country club and whose parents went to Yale. It's because the meritocracy itself has become a new kind of entrenched aristocracy, because people like me, you know, can afford to get our kids, you know, the tutoring on the SATs and send them, you know, to good private schools. And so they can compete in the meritocracy with tools that lots of other people don't have. And now the consequence for that is more than just, you know, what's the population of, you know, the elite colleges and universities in the country. The other consequence, the more important consequence for the country, is that if you admit, you know, smarter, more competitive, more striving people into elite higher education institutions, and then at the same time, law firms and banks and other businesses decide that they too want to be meritocracies, which is a good thing, what you end up with are law firms that are, you know, much smarter, frankly, than they used to be. So to the extent that, you know, the major law firms, just to take that example, are in the business of defending and advancing the interests of, you know, the biggest corporate clients that they can find, they now have much more talent arrayed in that battle. And as a consequence of that, you know, the lawyers and the bankers created all kinds of, you know, trailblazingly ingenious, you know, pieces of legal engineering and financial engineering, stock buybacks, derivatives, corporate takeover fights, which turned the American economy from an economy that produces things to an economy that produces financial instruments and legal instruments, you know, an economy that encourages corporations to do stock buybacks instead of invest in building new products.
Yeah, you have a great, I'm going to read your own book to you. Everyone loves that. Now
the ones
who flocked there were more likely to be smarter and tougher. You talk about the law firms and consultancies, because they were more likely to have gotten there through brains and hard work, not connections. They were better at winning, better at building moats to protect their winnings. And moats is a word that you use over and over in this book to describe our new world. And there's another phrase that you use. That's protected and the unprotected. That's how you divide America in this book a lot of the time. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that's the basic division in the country and the basic source of the kind of frustration in the country that got you know, Donald Trump elected, that got him, you know, the 46% of the votes that he got. And what I mean by that is that a moat is something that protects you and often protects you from the consequences of bad acts or overreaching, and protects you from having to participate in contributing to the common good. You know, an example of that would be, you know, a moat around the tax code so that you have all kinds of tax benefits and tax loopholes, and you don't have to chip in as much for the common good as you probably should. A moat, you know, enables you to hire squadrons of lobbyists to lobby against, you know, something in Washington that might in some way cut into your winnings, or to lobby OSHA to make sure that a job safety rule concerning, you know, the use of a chemical in a factory is delayed for 17 years and produces, you know, 2,000 pages worth of due process, you know, small print that the lawyers, you know, insist on. That's a moat.
And what do you mean? And the people who are unprotected are the ones on the wrong side of the moats?
Exactly. I mean, you can divide the country into two categories of people. People who, you know, they're independent, they work hard, they're self-reliant, but they depend on government, they depend on the community for the kinds of things that governments and communities have always provided. The best example is infrastructure, right? We've always expected, if we've expected nothing else, we've always expected our government to provide roads, you know, so we can, you know, use our cars to get where we want to go, or to provide, you know, mass transit, or to provide and regulate the power grid so that the power grid works, to provide a, you know, a water and a sewer system. You know, that is not even, you know, debatable. Any government anywhere is supposed to do that. But the protected don't really have to worry about that so much. They certainly don't have to worry about mass transit. They often have, you know, cars and drivers even, so they don't necessarily have to worry about being, you know, stuck in traffic as much. They can fly by, you know, private jets. So the fact that the airport terminals are grimy and ugly, you know, that's not their world. One of the points I make in the book to sort of illustrate the converse is that in New York until the mid-1990s, there were exemptions for jury duty for pretty much anyone who was part of a protected class. All lawyers were exempt. Doctors were exempt. If you were, you know, a corporate executive, you could write a letter saying, you know, I have to go to a board meeting that week, or I'm really busy, and you got exempt. In the mid-1990s, there was a new chief judge in New York, and she decided to get rid of the system of jury exemptions completely. Everybody had to serve. Within about 6 months, as I tell the story in the book, she'd be going to bar association meetings or dinners, and lawyers would come up to her and say, God, you've got to do something about the jury system. The room is grimy and filthy and ugly. The clerks are rude to us. You know, they treat us like garbage. You know, they don't have a system where they could call us the night before and tell us we don't have to come, and we have to show up, and we have to waste our time, and we can't bring our cell phones in or our computers. I mean, how can you treat people like this? And within a few months, she totally fixed it. The rooms got nice. The clerks got polite. They did a computer, you know, notification system so that people wouldn't waste their time by showing up when they didn't have to. Now, why did that happen? Because suddenly the protected were unprotected. They had power. They had access to her. And they demanded the kinds of changes that are just, you know, common sense, you know, decency that, you know, the government should have provided, you know, without her friends who are lawyers, you know, telling her about it. Well, you know, if you think about the Vietnam War, for example, the Vietnam War really ended when draft deferments for college kids started to be eliminated, because suddenly the Vietnam War affected everybody. And one of the key problems with our country is that there is very little about how the government performs or doesn't perform that affects people at the very top who have all the power. They don't have to worry about the public school system because they can send their kids to private schools, or they can live in neighborhoods where the public schools are really good and they're responsive to the parents. What do really wealthy people have to worry about the government for? Basically, national defense, because, you know, a missile, you know, would hurt everybody if it came down. Maybe renewing your passport, although you can hire expediters to do that. They pretty much are sort of, you know, vicarious participants in the kinds of common goods that everybody else has always expected their government to provide.
But don't the unprotected outnumber the protected?
For sure.
I mean, it's a democracy still. Why can't we get an infrastructure bill through then?
They outnumber them, but they don't outnumber them in terms of the phone calls they receive from members of Congress who, members of Congress spend 5 hours a day every weekday dialing for dollars, looking for, for $2,000 or $3,000 from campaign contributors. And they have to do that because they're worried about a super PAC that because of, Citizens United and other court decisions could swoop in at the very end and take away their seat in the House. So their constituents are not the unprotected. You know, their constituents are the people who are writing checks. I mean, that's just a plain fact. And to the extent they're worried about constituents, another great reform of the last 40 years, the election of nominees through the primary system has basically polarized our politics, where if you run in a Republican primary, you have to worry about the kinds of people who show up to vote in Republican primaries, who are usually very conservative. If you run as a Democrat in a primary, the people who show up are usually motivated and on the left. And the way you raise money to run in a primary is from, you know, the special interest contributors. So you basically have to appeal to your base and the special interest, not to the common good.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, and I'm sitting in for Carrie Miller today. I'm talking with Stephen Brill. His new book is Tailspin: The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. That's something that I really had never put together, that, of course, in 1968, part of the reason why the Democratic Convention blew up was because the party bosses decide who the nominee would be. And they decided to go through the grassroots and find the nominees through this caucus system and this primary system. And it was through the best intentions, and it is better than the smoky room, a handful of guys choosing who's going to be the next president or the next nominee for the party. But it really went off the rails.
Right. That was the year that Humphrey got the nomination, Hubert Humphrey got the nomination, a name that will be familiar to your listeners.
Exactly.
Without ever running in a single primary. Now, a lot of things happened that year, of course, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, but he had not run in a single primary, and he lost. And the reaction was, well, we can't do it this way again. Much of Tailspin is a story of good things that boomerang. The best example is probably the First Amendment. We all love the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. In 1976, a consumer rights crusader named Ralph Nader brought a lawsuit in Virginia. And the lawsuit he brought was aimed at allowing drugstores that were offering discounts on expensive prescription drugs to advertise their discounted prices. The larger drugstores in Virginia had lobbied to get a law passed outlawing the advertising of the price of prescription drugs. So Nader went in, his lawyers went in and said, the First Amendment is not just about speakers, because basically the status of the First Amendment at that point was you and I have a First Amendment right, but corporations don't, because they're not people. And Nader's argument was that listeners have a First Amendment right that is just as important, if not more important, than the speakers, because the whole idea of the First Amendment is to allow for a democracy to govern itself. And the way you do that is allowing listeners to hear all sides of an argument. So why should you discriminate against an argument just because of who's speaking? So why shouldn't corporations, in this case, these discount drugstores, be able to speak and advertise their discount prices? The Supreme Court said, you got a point. The First Amendment is important for listeners, not just for speakers. That began a long line of cases involving laws against campaign contributions, laws related to the product labeling of consumer products that has culminated, though it's kept going, with the Citizens United case, which again was about corporate free speech, and lots of associated cases, including cases, ironically, that have limited the right of the Food and Drug Administration to, in irony of ironies, require certain standards related to the labeling of prescription drugs.
And
so what starts out as a great thing ends up with not such a great result.
And similarly, the left was first embracing PACs. The unions were very excited about PACs when they started.
The first PACs were union, were organized by unions. And then the other side, the business interests said, hey, these guys are pretty smart organizing these PACs. Let's do that. And, of course, they quickly outdid the unions. By the same token, the arbitration clauses that I write about, the civil courts, and this culminated only this week in a new Supreme Court case, the civil courts have basically been closed off to individuals who want to sue for consumer fraud or for employment discrimination, because large employers and large sellers of consumer products like cell phones or Amazon, you name it, they all have buried in the agreements you sign with them that you have to arbitrate and you can't bring a class action, meaning that if your cell phone company has cheated you out of $30 a month for the last 2 years, you can't get together, with a million other customers of that company and bring one suit, which is the only way you could afford all the legal costs involved. You can only bring that suit to an arbitrator, and you can only bring it on your own behalf. So you're suing, for $30 times how many months you've been cheated. The same thing now with employment discrimination. Now, why did that start? Because the trial lawyers in the 70s and 80s so abused the class action a rep by bringing, all kinds of frivolous cases, and corporations would settle with them rather than risk the potential cost of a verdict, or basically as a way of getting rid of the suit without paying $2 or $3 or $10 million in legal fees. So that began too as a good thing, which, one side abused, and then the other side reacted with the shock and awe of these arbitration clauses.
Another thing that, I feel like we're just talking about, and this is bad and this is bad. We will get to things that you find
that are positive and people
that are working that are going to help some of these things. But I did want to give some more overview. When trade policy started opening up globally in the 60s, unions were big supporters of it because American workers were the best workers in the world. They're going to make things better. They're going to do everything better, and they will make the goods for the world and will open up trade, and American goods will flood across the globe. And that is not what happened. How did it turn?
That's exactly right. In 1962, when President Kennedy proposed what became known as the Kennedy Round of global trade, the first witness testifying in Congress on behalf of the new trade rules, the liberalization of trade rules, was the head of the AFL-CIO, the leading union. And again, the feeling was, we had just saved the world in World War II. We were invincible. Our workers, were now back home working instead of, being in the army. And the manufacturing base that we'd built up to build, war planes and war munitions was now being used to make, consumer goods, and, their efficiency was unmatched. The workers were unmatched. So isn't it going to be great? We can sell all these products all over the world. But it didn't work out that way. But what Kennedy did in 1962 was, even then they were aware that there could be victims of global trade, that some workers might lose out in competition with workers from other countries where wages were lower. So they added something to the trade bill called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act. And the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act allocated lots of money, like $1 billion, to retrain workers who lost their jobs as a result of trade. And one of the really sad stories of the tailspin is that from Kennedy through Johnson through Nixon, you know, all the way through Barack Obama, that program has been a fiasco. It's been ignored. It hasn't worked. It hasn't been funded well enough. And unlike every other developed country in the world, which sees the responsibility to retrain workers who are victims of automation or of global trade, every other country regards job training and retraining as the same kind of responsibility as K-12 education. We don't. And as a result of that, there have been victims of globalization, lots of them, tens of millions, even at the same time that globalization of trade is a good thing. It's a good thing for our economy. Our televisions cost a lot less. Our clothes cost a lot less. Our food costs a lot less. So the country as a whole has benefited. But again, the notion of the common good is that if you live in a community, you take care of people who are the victims of what is otherwise a good policy. And we haven't done that.
And it's not that people didn't have a heads up about it or have anybody saying, you know, maybe we should be training people better.
Exactly.
What was his name? Pete Peterson?
Paul? Yeah. There's this young rising Republican who's on President Nixon's staff named Pete Peterson, who ended up becoming the founder of, the giant private equity group, the Blackstone Group, multi-billionaire. He's on Nixon's staff in the White House, and he writes a long memo saying, globalization is great, but our education system needs to gear up and our job training system needs to gear up because the two biggest threats to the American middle class are automation and globalization, and we really need to start addressing this right now. And that was 1971.
It's amazing.
And he told me, I interviewed him for the book about a month before he passed away. He told me that, Nixon, just paid lip service to it. Everybody paid lip service to it, and no one did anything.
Yeah, I have a quote here from his memo that he wrote to Nixon about it. He said, "I believe we may be approaching a decade in which fundamental reorientation will be necessary to provide the career education, upgrading, and conversion of old to needed skills in the labor force of the 70s. And I feel like we could just cross out the 70s and put the aughts or the 20s coming up.
He got it right. And, the simple fact is, and I put some blame on my profession, too, that is an ongoing, story of a government responsibility and government programs that didn't work and they were just ignored. Nobody wrote stories about, what a disaster this was and how it wasn't doing anything for, people in Henry County, Virginia, whose jobs had been at a furniture factory that was, wiped out.
I'm Stephanie Curtis. This is NPR News. You're listening to author and lawyer Stephen Brill talking about his new book, Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. Brill pointed out that for a book called Tailspin, this reporting was not all bad news.
Your listeners will now be shocked to hear is shockingly hopeful.
It is. It is. I concur, and I found it very hopeful.
Is that, for example, you can do job training. This is not rocket science. You can retrain people. And I take my readers to a converted zipper factory in Queens across the East River from Manhattan where a Vietnam vet who graduated from Harvard has set up a nonprofit program that takes people who are sales clerks or messengers or one of them was a bouncer at a nightclub. People who are in jobs either or don't have jobs or are in jobs averaging $18,000 a year, and they spend 11 months being trained as software coders. And when they get out, they're being placed in jobs averaging $85,000 a year. It is a highly successful program. It is now scalable. And the difference is it's not a government bureaucracy. It doesn't say, well, if you don't have 2 years of community college, obviously we can't teach you anything. It really works. These people really care. And in all the spheres that I write about, whether it's political money or, you know, the polarization of policy, I find groups of people who are hard at work, you know, coming up with real solutions, not because they're naive or crazy or haven't gotten the memo that the country's on the wrong track, but because they are so frustrated about their country being on the wrong track, and they're so resilient that they are sort of laying the groundwork for when the country gets different leadership and starts to come back, as I think it will.
And the innovation, that training program where instead of just asking to get more grants, the man who founded it changed how it's funded too. Talk a little bit about that because
right.
I just found it so genius.
Yeah, this is just really smart. So what he does is when you sign up for the program, it's totally free. You even get a free laptop. Everything is free. You even get a stipend if you can't afford the subway fare to, you know, to get there. However, if they keep their promise and get you in a job paying at least $85,000 a year, you agree to pay, I think it's 5 or 6% of your salary for the first 2 years after that. Now, it's not a student loan. You don't get stuck if you don't get the job. You know, you don't owe anything. But if you do make money, you pay some of it back. And that has become, you know, something that it's not going to take more than another year or two before that will fund the program.
It's just amazing. And we are talking at the very beginning about in the, you know, in the 60s when the elite colleges and colleges across the country were trying to bring in new people and basically create a meritocracy rather than having the hereditary folks at the top. And there are some schools that are really trying hard to make sure that it's not just the kids of the meritocracy who've been, who've had summers off to go build homes in third world countries and get all the training and piano and whatever.
Build homes in Nicaragua so you can put that on your resume.
Yeah, they get to do everything as, I mean, I'm speaking from someone whose children go to 5 million camps during the summer and do amazing things. And they're trying to break out of that and get kids from the bottom quintile into their schools. And how are they doing that?
Well, just to give an example, I talked to the admissions director at Yale where I went, which has a pretty miserable record in doing what you've just described, you know, achieving economic diversity. But Amherst and Princeton, two, you know, equally elite schools, have actually done a really good job at it. And the way they do a really good job at it is they aggressively market the fact that they have really good financial aid programs. If you talk to someone who, you know, might be the valedictorian of her high school in South Dakota, and you know, maybe she's going to the University of South Dakota or she's going to a community college and say, well, you know, why didn't you go to Harvard? And she'd look at you like you were crazy. But the fact is Harvard is literally free for any family with a family income, I think, below $65,000. And it's almost free if it's like up, you know, if the income's like up to $100,000. But nobody knows it. So that person would say, oh, I can't afford to go to Harvard, when in fact they might be paying you know, $5,000 or $10,000 a year at the state university. Not that the state universities are bad, but if you want to achieve the diversity, which, by the way, is good for the students who are economically well off, it's just as good for them to be in an environment that is diverse as it is for, you know, the beneficiaries of a good financial aid policy. If you want to achieve that diversity, you really have to get the message out. And you also have to do things like help to, you know, ease the cultural burden or anxiety of a lower middle class kid who suddenly looks up and she's on the Princeton campus and is not used to the kinds of things and maybe doesn't even necessarily have the kinds of study habits that the more likely, you know, person on the Princeton campus might have.
I'm talking to Stephen Brill. His new book is Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. We've talked a lot about infrastructure, and that's one thing that President Trump said that he was going to get on his docket. He's going to get it done. They haven't gotten that done, but it's really hard to get a big infrastructure bill through because it costs a lot of money. But, you know, we had a bridge fall down here in Minneapolis not too long ago. And across the country, there are less dramatic problems with infrastructure. How can we get the common good to come, everyone to come together and realize that we need to invest in the infrastructure of our country before we become, I don't know, second world country?
Well, as you know, I write a lot about that bridge that fell down over, you know, over the Mississippi in Minneapolis, because I saw the whole story of that bridge as emblematic of the problem. The bridge was built during the heyday of infrastructure, and I think it was opened in the early 1970s or late 1960s. Mm-hmm. It was part of the Interstate Highway Program, Eisenhower's visionary Interstate Highway Program. And everybody knows if you build a bridge that opens in 1970, you know, by 1985 or so, you got to start worrying about, you know, you have to keep it, you know, in good repair.
Yeah.
And sometime in the mid-1990s, inspectors started to say, this bridge needs to be upgraded. There's, you know, there's rust here. There's corrosion here. These joints are loose. We got to fix this. And nobody paid attention. And then there'd be, you know, more inspections. And it became one of the something like 56,000 bridges in the United States by the time it fell, which was, I think, in 2007, is
mm-hmm.
it? Or, by the time it fell, it was one of 56,000 bridges in the United States rated as structurally deficient by the American Society of Engineers. Now, no one paid attention to it until it fell. Then they rebuilt it very quickly.
Yeah.
They put a new bridge in very quickly because obviously it got a lot of attention and it was an emergency and politicians could take the credit for getting the thing rebuilt so quickly. But nobody was paying attention when the inevitable was happening. And that is pretty much the story of infrastructure in the United States. Now, why is that? Well, there are two things going on at the same time. The first is that we have become so polarized that we can't even, as a country, as Democrats and Republicans, do the most apple pie American thing that there is, which is build bridges, you know, maintain our highways. Every president up through Ronald Reagan, you know, passed a slight increase in the gasoline tax. The gasoline tax hasn't been increased since 1993. Now, what does that mean? Well, the gasoline tax is 18.4 cents a gallon, if my memory serves. Well, 18.4 cents a gallon in 1993 yielded a lot more revenue than 18.4 cents a gallon yields today, because in 1993, you know, cars were getting 5 or 8 miles to the gallon, and you know, today they're getting, you know, 20, 25 or 30, or if they're hybrids, even more. Long and short of it is we get about half of the revenue that we used to get from the gasoline tax, and that's the stuff that is supposed to go for infrastructure. So the days when, you know, Democrats and Republicans would say, well, obviously we got to keep, you know, we have to keep our bridges up. We have to, you know, we have to build highways. We're not investing in the most obvious investment that any country should be making. The second half of the problem has to do with due process, which again is one of those values like the First Amendment that everybody loves. We are a country that is very you know, devoted to due process under law. The problem with due process is that it has become, for any construction project at all, any infrastructure project, a way for either environmentalists or people who don't want to pay the tax bill for the project to hold up the project. It takes, you know, dozens of approvals from dozens of different agencies to build anything in this country. Now, that is not an argument for not worrying about the environment. It's not an argument for not worrying about, you know, neighborhoods that may be, you know, dislocated or disrupted by a project. It is an argument for saying that it shouldn't take 11 years, you know, to get the plans for a new bridge approved. It could take, call it a year and a half. And that's what happened. And when you have that kind of delay, the people who are involved in the project, you know, don't even want to do it. The cost of the project just goes up and up and up every year, both because the approvals process is so expensive. And the longer you wait, the more the project will cost. In 1971, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey announced that they had to build a new tunnel for trains under the Hudson River. And the tunnel for trains under the Hudson River basically is the key artery connecting Washington to Boston, both for freight and for passengers. And they said in 1971, if we don't get this tunnel built by 1985, there could be a catastrophe because the current tunnel, I think, had been built in 1911.
Oh, geez.
And it was leaking. I mean, it was in really bad shape. And plus, it didn't have the capacity. So even if there wasn't a catastrophe, there'd be so many trains trying to get in and out of that tunnel that that commerce and passenger transport would really start to grind to a halt. That was 1971, target 1985. That train tunnel has still not been built, and President Trump just blocked it from being built. There is going to be a catastrophe there. When there is a catastrophe, we will build the tunnel in a year and a half. You watch. Just start to finish. Once they get the money for this, the approval process will involve 60 or 70 different state, federal, and local government agencies.
One other thing that you write about in the book that I found really fascinating because I'm interested in it was federal workers. And federal workers the workforce has been a way for women and African Americans, minorities, to get into the middle class, to get work experience, to become managers. It's been, a way to reach professional heights that they wouldn't have been able to meet in the private sector long ago. And it's really fallen into disrepair, the whole system. How has that occurred?
It's sort of fallen into disrepair from two directions. First of all, the notion the government service, the public service, is a really good, important thing that you can be proud of, and that government has a mission, and that if you serve in the government, you'll be well paid, and you'll get rewarded based on your performance. You'll get promoted based on your performance. That has kind of gone by the wayside in terms of the civil service in the federal government. It doesn't mean there aren't lots of fantastic workers, because as I explained, there are, and they should be rewarded more. But the protected, the people who don't care about, government helping them because they don't need the government's help, they don't pay any attention to that because, what does a government worker do? A government, worker helps to process a Social Security claim. The protected don't really care about that. You and I care about that. What they care about is national defense, though. So there's that side, which is recruiting, getting, training, and rewarding talent. The other side is that civil service in many ways, the civil service reforms, which were needed to get rid of the spoils system, in the late 19th century, have morphed into yet another moat where workers who aren't any good, who don't, who aren't performing well, are protected from any kind of disciplinary action or retraining or firing. The example I use is that the woman who was in charge of the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Phoenix that was the subject of, the scandal where waiting lists were doctored and veterans were, waiting forever, to get treatment. But but nobody knew about it because they were doctoring the data related to the waiting list. That woman who was in charge of that hospital, they tried to fire her, after they got all the facts. And she went through a series of appeals at something called the Merit Systems Protection Board. And the Merit System Protection Board judge ruled, and this has happened in lots of cases like this, even though she was in charge, she wasn't responsible for what had happened because her supervisor, in essence, had not explicitly told her, hey, can you check and make sure the waiting lists are right? That's wrong. I mean, there has to be, the major theme of the book, if there isn't any other major theme, it's for any society to work, there has to be a dedication to the common good, and there has to be personal responsibility and accountability for when you do something that is counter to the common good. And if you don't have, you know, personal responsibility, whether it's, you know, the CEOs of the large banks who crashed the economy and, you know, never got, you know, punished for it, or the woman in charge of this Veterans Administration hospital, if you don't have accountability, you lose any sense of personal responsibility. You make everybody else in the country a cynic. I mean, imagine how, you know, the other workers in that hospital feel that she wasn't held responsible, let alone how the veterans feel. You need to bring that back. Now, that doesn't mean you get rid of the civil service system. It means, again, as with a lot of other things in the book, you have to have guardrails so that you don't have too much of a good thing. In this case, the too much of a good thing is too much protection from responsibility for these government workers, at the same time that you don't have enough rewards for those who perform and enough recognition for those who perform.
This book is about how one decision played out over 50 years can make things worse instead of better. How do you make things right again? I mean, these little changes that you're talking about, could we see a change in America's future and how people feel about it in 5 years, 10 years, or do we have to take a 50-year trip to get back?
I think we are at an inflection point. As I say at the end of the book, you know, it is clear that the buildup of all these things, the sense in the country that the people at the top had, you know, no sense of responsibility and were not accountable just in, you know, in multiple spheres, whether it's a member of Congress who is the beneficiary of a gerrymandered district and never has to worry about, being reelected, or is the beneficiary of campaign contributions, he doesn't have to worry, or whether it's, that woman running that veterans hospital, or whether it's, the corporate CEOs who crashed the economy. I think the public is going to rise up and restore that sense of accountability. And I think that all the frustrated people who voted for Trump are going to see that he scammed them. He basically turned the middle class against the poor. He basically told the middle class, well, it's these immigrants that are responsible for, everything that ails you, when it's not true. And he promised them that he was going to fix everything. And it seems to me that, if you're a coal miner in Kentucky and West Virginia, by next year, you're probably going to realize, I actually never got my job back. He told me I was getting my job back. If you're a consumer who's been cheated, with the terms of a car loan, and you find out that the so-called reforms at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau were reforms that wiped out all the rules meant to protect you. If you're the victim of a payday lender and you find out that, the president that you voted for put these new rules in that take away all the restrictions on payday lenders, if the right politicians come forward who can unite the poor with the middle class the way, frankly, Robert Kennedy did, I think you're going to get change. And then all the people that I wrote about, the guy running the job training center at the Zipper Factory, the people fighting for campaign finance reform, all the people that I wrote about in different arenas are going to be there. They're going to have the work product, and they're going to have lots of troops that will follow them. I really believe that. I think this country is too resilient and can channel their frustration into something different that is not simply negative frustration.
That was lawyer and journalist Stephen Brill talking about his new book, Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. I'm Stephanie Curtis, and you're listening to NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.